Can you hear all right?
More or less. Turn up your machines. Let's start this morning with a little guided meditation practice. So yes, find your posture. Feel your body being uplifted from within, as the awareness of the Buddha comes into your own awareness, and you feel your body lifted and opened, sitting in a dignified, a human posture of peace and awakening. Feel the back part of your head lifting up toward the sky, your heart open, your spine lengthened, your chin tucked in, and your belly rising and falling, just gently and naturally, as you breathe in and out, with a beautiful rhythm. And use your imaginative power to vivify that breath, so that every breath really comes alive. And you actually can feel the depth and preciousness of every single breath, which is, after all, your life, right? That's your life, coming and going. So really appreciate every drop of life flowing through you, with every breath, and feel the breath suffusing and awakening the whole body, breathing in, brightening your spirit, breathing out, bringing peace and a deep relaxation with every out-breath. And feel that rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. And extend your awareness outside your body, to the space around your body. Truly, your body is that space. Feel in your very breath the presence of others in the room, breathing too. The building itself, the floor that supports you, the earth beneath that floor, the sky above, whose air you take into your body. Feel how this awareness is not just encased within your skin, What is awareness after all? We don't really know. It isn't yours or mine. It doesn't really have a limit or a boundary. There's no way to get outside of it and to say, this is what it is over there. So let's just take a moment or so more to rest in this awareness, to let ourselves afloat and be held within the embrace of this awareness. So this morning, I'd like to talk a little bit about compassion and mindfulness, because it's very popular to talk about mindfulness. So I'm sure all of you know that there's a sutra about mindfulness, the Mindfulness Sutra, Satipatthana Sutta. And it proposes four foundations of mindfulness, four subjects of mindfulness. Mindfulness being awareness, right? The same as awareness. The first foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the body. And the sutra begins actually with the breath and the posture, and goes on from there to speak about, so the simplest way to develop awareness of the body is to stop whatever you're doing and just sit down and start breathing and paying attention to the body and the breath without any complications. But then once you establish mindfulness of the body in that way, you can also be mindfulness of the body when you're walking forward or walking backwards or lifting something up or putting something down, or you can be mindful of the body when you're speaking. You can be mindful of the body when you're lying down to rest, in all postures, in all situations, aware of the body. And this foundation is first because it's the most fundamental and the most important. We never graduate from mindfulness of the body and forget about that and go on to other things, because our practice is always grounded in the body and in the breath. As long as we're alive, we're embodied, and we have that foundation for our awareness. And our awareness is never apart from the body. Based on awareness of the body, we can be aware of what's called feelings or sensations. And this is our deeply conditioned gut reactions to every single thing that we meet. We have some conditioned reaction, and we feel it in the body. We can feel it in the breath. It's hard to be aware of our feelings, sensations, without mindfulness of the body. Most people are subject to their conditioned responses and are not aware of them, because without the cultivation of awareness of the body, it's very difficult to gain any purchase on these conditioned reactions. When we are aware of the body and aware of our reactivities, we can then be aware of our emotions and thoughts associated with our emotions, because there's never an emotion without thinking, and there's never thinking without some emotion. So now we can have a different relationship to our emotions and our emotionally conditioned thoughts when we're grounded in the body and grounded in our feelings, sensations. We begin to see our lives in a different light. And the more we practice like that and see our lives in the light of awareness, we can see the patterns. We can see our own patterns of suffering very clearly. And we can also see the pattern of awakening. We can see how we're caught, and we can see how we can be uncaught and live lives of appreciation and openness. We see the shape of suffering and the shape of awareness, awakening, which is the same shape, just turned a little bit. And that becomes naturally something that comes into our awareness as we practice. So in other words, we're getting to know ourselves deeply. We're seeing how mind and body connect, always influence each other, and how we can balance both together. We don't let our minds run away with our thinking and churned by our emotions. We come back to our body. We understand ourselves better. So all this really amounts to really being present in a fuller sense, appreciating what it means to be present and alive, and extending our presence. And this is really the most important thing about our practice, appreciating and extending our presence, being willing to be fully honest and present with our lives as they really are. There's no way we're supposed to be, right? We're supposed to be the way we are. That's the way we're supposed to be. But we're supposed to be honest about that and really appreciating that. That's our practice. Our lives have to be as they are. They really can't be the way we want. Anyway, the way your life is so much more interesting than the way you want it to be. I think you see this after a while. It's so much more interesting what life really is. You realize the way I want life to be is so much smaller. It's just a production of my own limitations. Whereas the way life really is really just amazing. It's truly amazing. And we begin to notice this and appreciate it as we practice. So in this way, we keep coming back to our cushion and we really appreciate our Zazen practice. But we naturally are extending that practice into the whole of our lives. It extends into our thoughts. It extends into our feelings. It becomes a refreshed and renewed and really different attitude upon which we go forward into our lives. And we just very naturally, without even intending it or even knowing what we're doing, we can't help but become more generous, you know, more generously present with our lives and more variously willing to be there with all of our experience, to allow our lives to happen as they must, and to understand our lives in a wider scope than just ourselves and what we might think is good or bad for us. And when we start doing that, we find we're tripping over ourselves a whole lot less, getting in our own way a whole lot less, and we're willing to let life flow through us, over us, and around us. And once we get the hang of this, little by little, turns out there's a whole world we're living in. And the rest of the world and all of its color and amazement comes into view. The not us part of the world that we didn't notice even before, because the whole world was like basically us and what we wanted it to be and what we needed from it. Now all of a sudden the whole not us world comes into view. And we notice, by golly, there's other people out there different from us. And they're full of life too. They have their own histories and feelings and their own suffering and their own needs. In other words, really and truly knowing ourselves makes us more open and appreciative of others. And we realize that even though others are so different from ourselves, we'll never understand them even slightly. At the same time, they're just like us. They have the same life and the same basic impulses that we do. So this path naturally makes us more sympathetic to others. And this is not something we think about rationally or cognitive, some kind of cognitive concept or decision we make. It's mostly in the body. It's mostly an unfolding of human experience if we allow it. The body and the mind are not two separate things. They're one thing, life, we call it. Life is always embodied, and it's always conscious in some way. And wherever there is embodiment, there is some consciousness. Which means everything is alive. Everything is alive. The rocks, the trees, everything we can hold in our hands is alive. And everything is alive with us, together with us. But there's another dimension to this mindfulness, this awareness, that usually isn't really discussed. And that is, what is it, this awareness? What exactly is this that we're talking about here and that we're developing in our practice? What is it? What is knowing itself? What is cognizing itself? And who is it who is knowing what? And we little by little come to realize that our whole idea of awareness is always filtered through the idea of me, myself, and I. I am aware. I am experiencing this. I am knowing that. But the more you cultivate awareness, the more you realize that awareness is a larger category than I am aware. You know, the cultivation of awareness, of mindfulness, is not the same as hyper-self-consciousness, which I think a lot of people take mindfulness as a kind of hyper-self-consciousness. And now I feel worse about myself. I feel more how crazy I am, you know. I was obsessed with myself before, but since I started practicing mindfulness, I'm really obsessed with myself. I don't think that's what the Buddha had in mind. It was the opposite. To see that awareness itself is a larger category than me. It's not mine. It's not yours. It's some kind of presence that actually is beyond life, even. You feel it powerfully in the room where death has occurred. It's not my awareness. It's awareness itself that we're cultivating. And this awareness expands, opens, and heals. Because it opens us to a realm beyond ourselves, which is right here, in our breath, in our body, and in our awareness. So if you were to try to figure out, you know, what is this awareness, you would not be able to figure it out. You would soon realize that whatever you thought you had figured out immediately disappears under scrutiny. And that's why in Buddhism, awareness itself is called empty, meaning it cannot be described or understood or grasped or limited in any way. If you have a glass with no liquid in it, you might say the glass is empty. But then some bright person would say, yes, the glass is empty of liquid, but it's not really empty. It's full. It's full of air. Not full of liquid, but it's full of air. And that would be true, of course. And awareness is just like this. It's empty of any owner, empty of any substantial content, but it is full of love, of connection, of existence, non-existence, flowing in and out of itself. And that's why I began my talk today with meditation practice, because we were meditating on this very question that I'm speaking about now, right? We were resting in this ineffable, indefinable awareness. And this is Zazen practice. Zazen practice is mindfulness practice, but it's also something more. It's resting in this awareness and gradually feeling the love and connection that is its fundamental empty nature. Not that we can exactly experience it, because you can't experience something that's empty and doesn't really exist, you know, in the way that anything else exists. But through the instrument of human consciousness, we can be inspired by, have some sense of this great openness, even though we can't experience it. Sometimes we have spectacular experiences in meditation. And usually when someone comes and says this and this and this, you had to you say, oh, wonderful. Now, back to the cushion. Practice some more and see what happens. Because whatever experiences we have are encouragement. They're not actually it, because it isn't it, right? There's nothing to it, literally. So there's nothing to know and nothing to experience, but you have the sense. You have a love, you have an appreciation. And as soon as you try to define it or pin it down or think you have it in your pocket, there's nothing there. This endless, empty, indefinable awareness that isn't even existing is the basis of compassion. In training in compassion, my book, I use the traditional distinction in those teachings between absolute and relative compassion. Relative compassion is what we usually think of as compassion. Caring about others' pain and doing what we can to alleviate it. That's what we usually think of as compassion. Absolute compassion is our ongoing practice of appreciating the empty nature of awareness, which is what we're doing every time we sit down in Zazen, every time we chant a sutra, every time we make a prostration. We are appreciating the empty nature of awareness, which means the empty nature of our lives, of everything we will ever experience. And that means, as I just said, that reality itself, when we really appreciate it as it is itself open, loving, connected, and healing. If you're in need of healing, you will be healed, because life heals. And we learn that on our cushion over and over and over again. We learn it also through listening to talks and contemplating the teachings. And we learn it when we see those teachings come alive in our own lives. Not only at heightened moments of retreat or something like that, but every single day as we meet the daily challenges of being a human being. Little by little, we will see things differently. Little by little, well, we will see how obvious compassion is. It's everywhere. It's literally in the air we breathe. Thank you, air, for your great compassion. You've kept me alive all this time and asked nothing in return. Maybe a little less carbon, but other than that, you've been very generous. So you all know the Zen story about compassion. With our two, some of our most famous and wonderful, affectionate Dharma brothers, Yun Yun and Dao Wu, who are always practicing together and always asking each other and challenging each other, asking each other questions. And Yun Yun was the younger Dharma brother, and Dao Wu was always a little rough with him, as older brothers are. So Yun Yun said one day to Dao Wu, how come the Bodhisattva of compassion has so many hands and eyes? Because the Bodhisattva of compassion is depicted that way, iconographically. Lots of hands and eyes. Louder? Yeah, lots of hands and eyes. So Dao Wu said in response to that, did you hear the question? How come the Bodhisattva has so many hands and eyes? And Dao Wu replied, it's like reaching back for your pillow in the night. And Yun Yan said, oh, I understand. And Dao Wu said, what do you understand? And I'm not letting him off the hook. I sometimes do that. I sometimes say, oh, yeah, I understand. I don't understand. I understand. So Yun Yan says, the whole body is covered with hands and eyes. And Dao Wu says, well, that's pretty good. That's maybe 80%. So Yun Yan says, well, what would you say? And Dao Wu says, the whole body is nothing but hands and eyes. It's not just covered with hands and eyes. It's nothing but hands and eyes. So this is a story about absolute compassion. Reality is love, through and through. Not the love we want, not the love we project or desire, but real love, through and through. That things are born, you know, it's a wonderful thing. I am so grateful to all of you. You were willing to be born and go through this catastrophe, you know? Wow, you did it. Good for you. What a generous thing. Everything appears generously in this world for no good reason, and it's a tough world to be in, always. That things are so generously born, and that they, like all of us, naturally want to continue to live and further their lives and do all kinds of things to further their lives, all the way until they don't anymore, and then they leave this world, offering the material substance of their bodies to the planet to be further used, literally to give the substance of our bodies to the earth and the sky, and the refinements of our consciousness to roll on into other lives. Everything does this, going on and on and on, circulating. Giving the gift of your life to the lives of those yet to be born. We all do this. This is how reality is. It's immensely generous, immensely compassionate and loving. And this whole thing is as natural as reaching back for your pillow in the dark. You don't need to think about it. You don't need to do anything other than reach. And you don't even have eyes to see. Your hands have, your fingertips have eyes in them, and they find the pillow. There's no intentionality involved. There's just being willing to live. Actually, as cruel as this world is, it's just as kind. And there are so many people who practice relative compassion because there are so many caring people. Wherever you go, you're going to find mostly caring people. But caring people often can't sustain their caring. They have a word for it, I think, in the helping professions. Sometimes, I don't know if they still use this term, but they call it compassion fatigue. You know, you get mad at the people you're trying to help because they're not getting better. And they're not even grateful to you for all you've done for them. I'm fed up with you people. I've been helping you for years. What the hell with you? And then people say, you know, I'm too empathetic. I'm too nice. I feel people's pain too much. And after a while, I can't stand it anymore. Get me out of here. It's really upsetting. But when you can balance relative compassion with absolute compassion, then you don't burn out anymore. And you're not expecting anything. You're not expecting that someone's going to get better. You're not expecting that they're going to be grateful to you. Why do you do it? Because that's what reality does. That's just what human beings do. You don't think you're being compassionate. You don't even think there's any such thing as compassion. There is just the wholehearted willingness to fully embrace life and death. To face life on every occasion with open awareness. You really understand, you really get it, that within the sphere of empty and perfect awareness, there is no loss. And there is no pain. And even though you don't experience it like that, because after all, you're just a human being, and you do experience loss and pain, you know this is true. You know it's true. And this sustains you, even as you feel the suffering. And you can be compassionate, and it doesn't have to be exhausting. In fact, it can be joyful, oddly. The suffering can be joyful and nurturing, even though at the same time it's painful. Because compassion has to do with pain. That's what the word means, to be suffering with. And it requires that we train our hearts to go toward rather than away from pain. And this is exactly the opposite of what we all want to do, right? You see pain, you want to go elsewhere. You want to make the pain go away, or you want to go away, one or the other. Going away from pain is a natural self-protective reflex. It's built into the body and mind. It's a deep animal reflex. But that reflex exists when we are limiting our awareness to self-awareness. When we bound our awareness with self-concern, that's when we are subject and have no choice but to be reflexive in that way. That's why we have to be realistic and honest about our practice. It takes a while. It takes a lot of time on our cushions and in our lives to little by little by little by little extend awareness until we can gradually learn not to turn away from pain, but to turn toward it. And when we see ourselves turning away, to know what we're doing, and then little by little turn toward. When we can turn toward pain, we can actually practice compassion. Not just think we're practicing compassion, or not just feel compassionate, but actually practice compassion. And as I say, this takes some doing. So we're all working on it. We're all not getting there, but we're all working on it. So here are three counterintuitive points about compassion. First, what I just said, it's about embracing pain, not making pain go away. We think of compassion as, I'm going to take away the pain. I'm compassionate, I'm taking away everybody's pain. Compassionate, we may work to take away pain, but real compassion is embracing the pain. Based on that, let's try to take away the pain, but let's not avoid or deny the pain. Sometimes we help because we can't stand pain. Actual compassion is facing and embracing the pain. Second, if you're going to embrace the pain of another person, you can't do that unless you're fully willing to embrace your own pain. And we all have suffering. Even very privileged people with nothing wrong suffer. Everybody, by virtue of being born into a human body, is in pain. You have to first recognize your own pain and see in the other yourself. And this can be the most difficult of all. Sometimes people have an easy time embracing the pain of others and just can't touch their own pain. Compassion is not self-sacrifice. It's not forgetting yourself. It's understanding yourself and embracing yourself. And third, although at first we will resist doing this, when we actually have the experience of turning toward and really embracing the pain, at the heart of it, at the heart of the pain, is peace. We'd never expected that. It's beautiful and profound to really love another person and be able to take in their pain. And you realize that all this time, when you were acting out this natural impulse to run away from pain, you were causing yourself so much more anxiety. It wasn't really ever working, avoiding pain. It never worked. It seemed like a reasonable idea, but actually it never worked, because all it did is make you more and more afraid and create more and more anxiety in your life, because pain cannot be avoided. Seemingly, you can put it off for a while, but not really. So every time we turn away from pain, we increase our anxiety, and every time we fully face it, we find peace. In Mahayana Buddhism, awakening and compassion are the same thing. they're discussed using different words and different discourse as skillful means, but in the end, they're exactly the same thing. Compassion is awakening. Awakening is compassion. To awaken spiritually is to awaken to the fact that our limited awareness isn't who we are, and it never was, and it's not how we want to live. To awaken is to appreciate our real human nature, which is expansive and inclusive of others. And when we understand this about who we are, we cannot turn away from pain. And when we do turn away from pain, we understand what that is. That is our own pain, making more pain. We can't do that anymore. We have to go toward the suffering. There isn't actually anywhere else to go anyway. And when we turn toward that pain with a heart of caring, we are opening ourselves to love. And what could be better than that, right? We all, it's amazing. You know, the billions of us on the planet were so stupid and wrong-headed and cockeyed in every way, you know. I mean, it's embarrassing. And yet, pretty much, whether they act this way or not is another matter, but pretty much wherever you go, everyone will agree. Yes, love is the most important thing, even though nobody even knows what love is, you know. And yet somehow, there's a kind of like general consensus on this point. And we find love when we awaken. Okay, so I'll close with a passage from our dear Aoyama Roshi, who has such a wonderful way of expressing these things. And this is called, Savor Every Moment in Life. The taxi driver was grumbling. This kind of work is pretty worthless, and I know it's all I'm ever going to do with my life. Quite spontaneously, I retorted, your job is certainly not worthless. You become both arms and legs for people, carrying them where they need to go. People like me could never manage without you. An understanding driver always goes as close to the speed limit as he can go to get me to my destination on time. And even though I'm forever going about here and there, I never take an umbrella with me, and the driver kindly shields me from the rain and takes me under the umbrella right up to the place I want to go. And he helps me carry my bags, because wherever I go, even if I'm not going on a long trip, I always have as much baggage as a person could carry. And the cab driver always helps me with my luggage. And I have no sense of direction, but the driver always knows where to go. And if he doesn't, he looks up his Google Maps. And taxi drivers deliver home safely people who missed the last train because their meeting was delayed or they were out drinking too late. If somebody has to go to the hospital all of a sudden, the taxi driver can save your life. When no one else can take you where you have to go because everybody's on holiday or it's the middle of the night, you can always get a taxi. So don't say your work is stupid work. It's the greatest job. It's wonderful. Don't you agree? And then she says, it was a kind of a long ride. So I went on. You can imagine the taxi driver, and there's this little Zen priest in the back seat yakking away, giving him all these Dharma talks as he's driving. So she said, so I went on, she said. I seriously believe that there is not one worthless thing, not a single useless thing in the whole world. The other day I gave a lecture at a company that manufactures watches and calculators, when the lecture was over, the company president took me on a tour of the factory, and I was really impressed. The thing about Zen people, they're impressed with everything. You know? Wow, there's a bug. Oh, amazing. You know? That's true. You know? So she was impressed with this factor. I watched parts being assembled that can be seen only with a microscope and on a conveyor belt at that. If one of those parts being poked around by the point of a needle should be out of place to the tiniest extent, the entire watch or calculator will be out of sync or would stop altogether. I felt very keenly how each single part shouldered the work of the entire piece. And I thought that one household, or to widen the image a bit, a society or country, or to widen the image even further, heaven and earth, and even the universe itself, function in the very same way as one of these watches. Most people see things in terms of superior and inferior, higher and lower values, but seen from the standpoint of truth, there are neither superior nor inferior, neither higher nor lower values. No matter where you begin, the entire family, the entire society, the entire universe is fully in place at every single point. The perspective alters quite dramatically if we are alert enough to see the difference between the biased view that our work is merely one trifling mechanical part and the attitude that whatever we do, it shoulders all heaven and earth, all past, present, and future. When Shakyamuni Buddha was born, he pointed to heaven with one hand and to earth with the other. And you might have heard this story, Mr. Taxi Driver, how the Buddha pointed like that. And he said, "I alone am the world-honored one in all the heavens and on earth." And what he meant by that is that all sentient beings have ultimate value. No matter what person, what kind of work, what flower or bird, they have all received the great gift of life from heaven and earth, whether they realize it or not. And then she says, that's the end of her speech to the cab driver. And then she says, "Maybe it was presumptuous of me to talk about all this for the driver so long, but he listened." And I was glad that at the end he said, "Well, what you say gives me hope. I'll try to do my best." Zen Master Shuedo said, and this is one of the, you'll maybe recognize this from the Book of Serenity, 1, 7, 3, 5. "The truth you search for cannot be grasped. As night advances, a bright moon illuminates the whole ocean. The dragon's jewels are found in every wave. Looking for the moon, it is here, in this wave, in the next." And she says, 1, 7, 3, 5 is supposed to suggest life's unpredictability. Anything can happen. Life does not follow a set pattern. If we wonder where truth is hidden or whether we can find worthwhile work, we will restlessly look beyond ourselves. But just as the moonlight glitters on the crest of every wave, everything and every person is important and has his or her own splendor. Not a single thing is insignificant. This is what Zen Master Dogen taught in Tenzo Kyokan and Fushoku Hampo and other texts, where he talks about the Dharma of washing your face, the dharma of going to the toilet, the dharma of cooking a meal, and so on. Every single thing and every single person expresses the full of the dharma. Let's not miss it. So we talk about love. We have no idea what love is, you know. We talk about it as if it were a feeling, but all feelings are fleeting, right? The person you love, and the next minute you hate them. You would never say that, because you say, well, I love this person. But look at how you're feeling right now. You hate them right now. That's real, you know. Well, that's true. So love is not a feeling. Feelings change. Love is a great big abstraction, a great big fluffy, warm idea. So is compassion. But actually, each and every thing that appears is already love, is already compassion. To appreciate each and everything that arises as it is, as we feel it, with our human feeling, with all the longing and confusion involved in being human, that is love, and that is compassion, and that is the only thing our practice is about. So a few days before coming here, Kathy and I went outside, and the moon was nearly full, and the sky was pretty clear at our house, and we could see the moonlight on the ocean, just like Swedo describes in his poem. Up in the sky, the moon was yellow and round. But if you look down on the water, the moon was everywhere, everywhere, making the water beautiful. No part of the water didn't have the light of the moon in it. The whole ocean was lit up. Human beings are always looking for something. We'll never stop looking for something we think we don't have. And it's beautiful. We'll keep looking forever, and we'll never find it. But somehow, even as we're looking, we can stop looking and just be willing to receive the gift of this life, which, although they keep saying in Buddhism it doesn't last long and it's impermanent, that's actually not true. It lasts forever, this life, forever. No matter what life brings, no matter what happens, moonlight is everywhere. Everywhere. And forever. Don't forget. Okay? Keep on practicing. Forever. And when you're done, make sure the next guy keeps going. And if you lose track of your practice for a day or a week or a year or a decade or two or three decades, that doesn't matter. Just time goes by fast. The next breath, jump back on. Practice will be there for you. It doesn't matter. So thanks, really, everybody, for your... You really inspire me. You're fantastic Buddhism bodhisattvas. It's awe-inspiring. But don't forget and keep it up. Thank you.